John Stewart had been a chef or chief cook on the railroad.
Yeah.
And he decided to come to La Grande.
Well, I don't know exactly when he came, but one of my fond memories was that I carried newspapers that had the Oregonian, and we went down to the Oregonian to the Railroad Express office and got our papers. And
this when you were a boy?
Yes, yeah. When I was a young kid. And John was the first stop on my route, which always included something to eat. But he saw to it that he became a very good friend. And then his wife, after John passed away, which was, I can't tell you when, but it was a long time in the past to me. With my mother and I, after my dad passed away, we lived up on 6th Street there. And Mrs. Stewart helped my mother, get along because her health wasn't too good. And she became, had been this old long relationship anyway, and she was just a dear friend too. So we had a lot of good friends of the black people. And like I told you the other day, I wasn't aware. I probably did things wrong sometimes, I don't know. But I was not aware of feelings of, they were just people. I'm sure that I know there was a lot of people in the Grand that didn't feel that way about it. But it certainly, I hope I was not guilty of any of the things that I found out later went along.
Well, I think you would have known from them if they felt negative toward you.
Yeah.
What can you remember about the inside of John Stewart's cafe and the kind of food he served?
Well, as I remember, it would be on the corner where the auto parts store is now. It would be, let's see, Jefferson and, can't say what that little street is there that faces runs right along the by the where ODS office is that little piece of a street. I can't say what the name of it is right now.
But, next to the Foley Annex.
Yeah. And his little place was just on that corner. Those buildings are all new since those days. But I believe that's where it was, because it was just across from the depot and down a little, and up toward Portland a little bit.
Yeah.
And anyway, that's where he had his little place. And I think it was, considering the times and Depression times and everything, I don't think it was that anybody got rich doing what they were doing, but it was certainly a good place.
Did it have a counter and stools?
I don't remember. I can remember tables and chairs. I don't know whether. I don't think there was a counter. It was just, I think, just a kind of an open room, and I don't remember. I remember the kitchen was back there, and
so that was out of sight of the customers.
Pardon?
That was out of sight of the customers.
No. It was put it this way. It had a minimal amount of, not like it is today. You didn't have fancy booths and all that. You just tables and chairs mostly, and I don't really recall it, except that I have the feeling that it probably was just part of all one big room, and then I'm sure there was some way to have food as it was prepared. You weren't looking at the cook stove while you were there. It's just part of it. I'd say kind of a primitive restaurant in those days.
John did all the cooking, do you think?
As far as I know, yeah. Well, Mrs. Stewart helped him in that time. Yeah, she.
Did she wait table?
Well, I'm sure she did. I don't think there were that many people in there. I don't know that I ever went there as a family group to go there to eat, because my eating was done. I learned in the newspaper that
gets on the run, huh?
Yeah. But
did they serve breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
I can't tell you that. I know they had lunch and dinner. I know that. I'm not sure about breakfast.
Were there usually a lot of customers in there?
It seemed to me that they had a good trade. That
mostly men?
I wouldn't. No, I couldn't.
No. Okay. Okay.
We had that area of town in those days. There was a Chinatown down just below.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Chinese and they're right across from the post office, or where the city building is now. City. That used to be the old post office.
Mm-hmm.
And there was down just this side of, well, right adjoining where Max Park is now, there was a little Chinese place sat back in there, just a wood frame building. And then around the corner, going down 4th Street, past the old Safeway building down there, and the block behind it where that tire place is now, Commercial Tire, I think it is, that was all Chinese. And they had the Chinese, they had troubles here. They get on what they call Tong Wars. I don't know what a Tong was. It was some kind of a club or something. And Mrs. Laughlin was her name, and she lived right across the street on 4th Street, the parking lot that adjoins the Chamber of Commerce, and that right in there. There was an apartment house there, and that was the old Ford garage Cy Perkins' Ford garage. My mother and I lived in this apartment next to, in Mrs. Laughlin's. I think there's three apartments there, two on the first floor, and then Mrs. Laughlin lived upstairs. And she was standing on the, as far as I know, and maybe somebody can correct on the details of this particular thing, but she was standing on the steps of what was then the post office. And the Chinese were in some kind of a scrap going on, I don't know what it was, but somebody fired a shot and it hit Mrs. Laughlin in the foot or the leg, and that caused quite a bit of furor in the ground.
Oh, because I'm sure it did.
And so it was, the Chinese got somewhat of a bad reputation, and I don't know the details of that, but at one point in time, this was probably in the within the first 15 years of the 1900s. I understand that they rounded all the Chinese up, stuck them on a train, and told them to get them out of here. In spite of that, the ones that weren't running out of here, the ones that stayed, well, they did, they were not picked on one way or the other. But whoever this group of people were involved in shooting, I guess now I may be wrong in some of these details, except I do know, and I know some of the people that took part in getting the Chinese out of town, which that's the only time that I ever knew of you might say a racial incident around here that was of any seriousness. But anyhow.
Is it your understanding that the reason the Chinese came here in the first place was to work on the railroad?
Yes, but there were a lot of Chinese miners.
Oh yes, that's right.
Lots of Chinese miners. And they did all sorts of things. Now right where the present, the new Safeway is, when I was a child, that was the whole area where the Safeway sits now was a great big garden. And the Chinese, all I know, they were very little people. We weren't very big. And we had gambling halls all down on Jefferson and, in fact, on Adams down there. And those Chinese loved to gamble. And those poor devils would get down there and they'd work all day long on their hands and knees. I never saw anything except the most primitive Chinese tools, mostly on your hands and knees and scraping with rudimentary. In other words, there's no equipment. It's all handwork. But they farmed that whole big place, about four of them. And they did a good job. And had this funny old fellow called Friday. And he had a little hack or something with a big old funny horse, and he had this big black dog that always followed him. Walked behind that wagon, and they go all around town, and the reason he got this name Friday, as I understood it, why his sales pitch was that you better buy now, I won't be back till Friday. That's not all. But he trailed up, and he came to our house. He covered a lot of area. He'd come by, and people would buy, buy his vegetables. And they were very fine vegetables, too. But he was quite a town fixture. And,
were some of these Chinese vegetables, like bok choy?
Oh, no. I don't know. I was so darn young at the time. All I was fascinated by that Chinaman and that wagon and that horse. This old horse looked like he was something out of a cartoon. And that big black dog, he had a great big, I suppose you'd call it a Labrador Retriever type thing, you know. The biggest dog, to a young kid, I don't know the biggest dog I ever saw. But he was always just three or four steps behind that wagon, just followed him every place he went. But they lived in little, almost like cardboard shacks on that ground. I don't recall ever being a regular house. I don't know what the poor devils did to stay alive, but they sure gambled a lot.
They were here year-round?
Oh, yeah.
Because the gardening would only occur for about six months, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I don't know what I never thought about what they might have done when it wasn't gardening, but there, where the new old Safeway building is, that piece of street, that piece of 4th Street to run down there, there was, on that first block off of Adams, on the left-hand side, there was a big two-story building, and that was some kind of a Chinese club or something, gathering place. And most of the kids, we were about halfway afraid of the place, but a kid, a neighbor of mine, where we lived up in town, he had a bicycle and I didn't have one. Anyway, we'd get the urge to get firecrackers. And we'd get up enough nerve to go down there to the corner of 4th and Adams. And that building was just the doors on the left-hand side of the street. We would get up enough nerve to go in there, and I think they knew what we wanted before we ever got there, but some way or another you made yourself, some English spoken again, but we'd get firecrackers. And we'd almost run to get out of there and get back to safety on Main Street.
Well, did anything ever happen to you as a result of mixing with the Chinese?
No. I'm sure they were all nice people, except there was some opium, because when they dug up that land, the old Grand Hotel was there. You might have seen the picture there or not. When they dug that up, I think even after the hotel had been built there, when they dug that up to put the Safeway store in, there were some, I think there were some shacky-type buildings just beyond that bigger building, which was a pretty fair building. Then across the street, where Fourth would go on down and it runs into the railroad tracks, there were some shacks down there, just really Chinese-looking shacks. But anyway, when they dug that up, they found opium jars all down in the, you know, like...
sort of a cellar?
Well, I don't know, they were just down there. But they, I can't remember who it was, got a bunch of those. And they bought them from, I don't know who had the rights to sell the stuff or whatever they did. It's somebody here in town that I didn't know, but they had quite a, back in the Observers, there were some write-ups about about the opium things that they found as artifacts in that ground down there. But then if you went down fourth till you came to Jefferson, then turned right and went back toward up toward where John's kitchen, there were some shacks along there that had Chinese people in them. And I don't know of any real, I never had a feeling that the Chinese and the blacks ever had anything to do with one another. They may have, but I had that feeling that they didn't. I don't think that.
Most of the Chinese didn't speak much English, did they?
Not a lot.
That'd be one reason.
Yeah. Well, you know, they dug holes in the ground like they were at Pendleton and that underground place that the Chinese had down there right under the main street now. And there was one up in Baker, but there was never anything like that here. It was pretty interesting. It was kind of a mix. You know, there was some Indians here that worked for, in later years, the Manaman Lumber Company.
Now, I wanted to have you talk next a lot about the Indians.
Well, there was one, because of my church connection, Presbyterian Church, I was on the session at the time, and Gilbert Connor was still alive, and then his daughter, Leah, and his son, Ray. Leah is, I think, she's younger than I am. But they came over here to church things there, and there were others that came to these some of the things, and so we got kind of acquainted there. And then there was a couple of families of Indians around here that I'm sure they had reservation rights, but they didn't live. They lived around here, and they were well-respected people, from time to time, there would be groups of Indians that, I suppose, just like anybody else, wanted to go someplace else, so they came over here, and they used to trade with some of the merchants around here and everything. It's kind of hard to talk about them because everybody thinks they're always drunk, and they're not. A lot of them were, but there were an awful lot of that Connor family and the George family and Minthorns, and then the horrible name, but Cowapoo, Willie Cowapoo. He was a pretty good athlete up here at the school. He played basketball. We used to get such a kick out when we'd go to the basketball games, and the Indians would come in, and they were dressed, you know, just like, I don't know if you're familiar with how Indians dressed back then, but they all had these big wide hats. They never pushed the crown down until this, all on that. And they had braids sticking on everything. Well, they'd always seem like they got there just before the game started. They'd file in, and they had a place where they sat. Right, it was the rest of the crowd, but they always sat in a straight line. All walked down this. They had literally had a place saved for them. March in there, sit there and watch the game. Wouldn't change the expressions all the way through the game. And it didn't clap, didn't cheer, just sit there. Watch the game, and as soon as the game was over, they'd all get up and file out. Just take what everybody did. But
were these college games?
Yeah, yeah.
Did they come because one of their own was
playing?
Yeah,
well, Willie Cowapoo, and then Ray Connor. He went to school here. He taught my niece at the North Powder School after he got out. Leah, I don't think she ever taught around here. She got, I don't know where she taught first, but she later on, she was on the Warm Springs Reservation as a I guess what you'd say, superintendent or whatever she was, but she had a responsible job there. And she was trying the basic, her, I took it that her job always was to get the kids to go to school. And over there on the warm spring set up, why, they went to school at Wasco. And they'd go to school. It was her job to get them to school or whatever, or try to get them to school. And they'd come, and then whenever they felt like it, they'd get up and leave. Well, the people in charge of the education would not learn happy with the kids the way they did things. And Leah told them just in so many words, and I looked, you're lucky if they come to school tall. They don't have any, they don't really understand anything about the system. We're trying to teach them about that. Now, this is fairly recent time, see, because in my time, but anyway, she said, if they come, if they get here at 8 o'clock, if they stay at 2 hours, get up and leave, you've had them for 2 hours. And maybe over time we can break them into this so that they might actually, down the road, we'll have kids completing school. But that's where it started from. And another funny, she talked about, they had different churches there. All the do-gooders are going to convert to Indians, you know. So they sent a ministerial delegation to wherever her offices were. They said, we don't understand. We asked the Indians, will you come to church? Yes, we'll come to church. And Sunday comes, and they're never there. She says, what time's your church? And she was raised a Presbyterian, so she knew what we were doing. She was getting a big kick out of it. She says, well, okay. What time do you have church? 11 o'clock. Well, why don't you have it at dawn out on the mountain? That's when they go to church. If you want to talk to them, you have to go where they are. They're not going to come here. Well, over time that broke down because... But you see, those cultures were still in the process of trying to understand one another. It was quite interesting to...
It sounds as though you had quite a number of conversations with Indians.
Yes.
Did they tell you stories from their past, their parents and their grandparents?
No, not much. I don't think that... Was that unless you knew their parents, through, like we did through... the church or something like that, there was very little connections. Like those Indians coming to see the football basketball game, that was a connection.
Well, I thought specifically they might have known about their tribal members and some of the other tribes who came to the Grand Ronde Valley regularly over many years.
Well, I'm sure they did, but I don't. That was not a thing that you could bear. The only real recollection that I have with the Indian people, out on the foothill road, clear down the road from the time you turn off of Gecker Lane and start down there and go out to Ladd Canyon, the Smoots family there and the Gecklers and those people, they had gained access to that land over time, you know. Of course, the Oregon Trail ran right through there. And all I can really remember about that part of it, that the Indians would come down to D. Smoots's place, which is the closest area to where the Ladd Marsh type played there. And that was kind of damp in there. And they used to come and gather camas. And there's hardly any Smoots's left. I wouldn't know anything about that. I think mostly all the kids and grandkids, because all the rest of them are dead. But that used to be quite a thing to go down and there, and that's where Connors came there, and they had teepees, and there's just that piece of ground right kind of just this side of D's and out in that field. It's still alive with camas, one of the very few people places it is. But I can remember camas cakes were given to me, and they used it a lot of different ways. They dug the roots for and made flour out of it. And they mixed it kind of like pemmican. They mixed fat with it, and then they put berries and stuff in it. And they cooked them some way that, over smoky fires, you know. And they always had bags of those with them, you know, to eat. Pretty good food. And as I remember, it was, you know, they tasted fine.
But now, I assume that these most recent Indians who were gathering camas didn't really need it as food. Maybe they were carrying on a tribal tradition.
Yes, yeah. Well, yes, because you've heard of camas, the camas country up in Idaho.
Yeah.
And Cricket Flat.
Yes.
It's hard to imagine now, but that used to be alive with camas. And there were lots of places where there was a lot of it. That place over down there by the marsh was exceptionally good. And I don't know why, but never really thought about what it took to grow camas.
Except it needs a lot of water.
Yeah, but anyhow.
But 100 or more years ago, camas was a major food source for the Indians, wasn't
it?
Oh,
yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's like pemmican. You can just store it forever. And it's like old John Wayne in that movie with Katharine Hepburn when the Chinaman made him, whatever he called him, I'll say dogops, but that wasn't the word for it that he used. He always had a big bag of them, corn dogs, corn something. This Chinaman made this stuff and measured them up to his hand. I guess whether they were cooked or not, but anyway, they always had a bag full of them. If they had something to eat, as long as they had corn dodgers, that's corn dodgers. That was in that movie. Well, that reminded me of the camas because they always had that with them. And I'm sure that they used that to a great extent to get by hard times or food that they didn't have to fool around with on their route. The Carter family, he was in the education.
Harvey,
yes.
And Genevieve.
Yeah. Well, Harvey and his father. Now, his father was half breed. Harvey was quarter. And Mr. Carter, they lived out kind of on the north side out there, back over in here someplace. And he he'd been raised in Oklahoma. He was Cherokee.
Harvey's father?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But his Cherokee were Eastern, but that's where they were put. And I don't know the story of how he, what the setup of parentage was. But he was a great man. I just thought the world of him, even after Ellen and I, if we were still going together. And he was living in just kind of a little old garage-type shack that was on the place where the Carter family lived. And anyway, I'd go down to see him, and Helen, she went with me a time or two. Anyway, he didn't have much in there. So I had a real nice rug at this furniture store I worked for. It was a trade-in, a pretty good rug. And I got thinking about it. I got to take that down to Mr. Carter. So he just had like tar paper nailed on the floor. And we had to move a bunch of it, and we got that rug. And it kind of fit the room pretty good, you know. He was quite pleased. But we went back on the Minum one time we rode all the way from our horses were up here in Knoll Town and different places. We rode across the valley and went up to where Moss Springs is now and dropped into the Minum and started our trip from there. And then we wandered around, I don't know, we'd been gone a couple of weeks, I guess, and my mother and Genevieve's mother and Genevieve, Harvey had this funny old car. It was a coupe. It was one kind of small car. It wasn't as big as anything harder. It was even around those days, it was a small car. Anyway, they drove clear up the end of the Lostine River, up there, the camp up there at the top, and brought us fresh supplies. Here the three of them met us. I think we're out 6 weeks altogether, and we rode all over every place.
This was a summertime ride?
Yeah.
Do you know why the older Mr. Carter had come to the Grand Ronde Valley?
No, not really.
Had he lived here a major part of his life?
I can't fill you in on those details. I really don't know, because by the time I really became aware, the Carter family, as such, was quite a few people in the family. And they were, I don't know, they just, there weren't a lot, you didn't know a lot about the family. I knew Harvey real well, I knew his dad real well.
Harvey was just a little older than you?
Yes, he probably was 10 years older than mm-hmm. me, because he was about my brother, older brother, next brother. My closest brother was 10 years older than I was. And Harvey was probably a little younger than Ed, in between me and my brother Ed. So,
would you describe him?
Pardon?
Would you describe him the way you remember him?
Harvey?
Harvey?
Well, he had very Indian look, high cheekbones, just a hiker, walked. When we had our cabin, well, we still have a cabin, Harvey was very active in scouting forever. And that's kind of where I met them, except my brother, the family knew him there. I kind of met him later when I got into scouting. And Harvey, he was a fantastic swimmer, swam the length of the Lyle Lake back when not many people did. And he would be at the Methodist Church campground. They all belong to the Methodist Church. There, and he would get up early in the morning, and he'd hike clear to the top of, we always called it Middle Mountain, I guess it's Bonneville, Middle Mountain, the big mountain that's always in the picture. He'd hike up the back of that and hike around it, and we'd just be getting started to get up and get breakfast and stuff at the cabin down. We were down below, about from the foot of that mountain, probably a half mile, three quarters of a mile. And here Harvey had come, and he'd sit and have breakfast with us. And that went on a lot. And Harvey taught me how to swim. I was not a good swimmer in the beginning. And he took me down to the lake this one time and said, "Now we're going to get your head underwater." Because he'd given up on trying to teach. I had a bad experience by getting ducked and thrown into a swimming pool that was in the basement of a Elks Club. He went through some windows in the floor at street level and walked in on a plank to get down there, and they're going to teach swimming lessons. Well, I get in this dark place, and I didn't like the looks of that thing, and there's a lot of people down there. About that time, somebody shoved me in the water, and I got out, and it really branded me. I had a terrible time. Anyway, Harvey finally said, "Now, I don't know, I must have been 11 or 12. Said, we're going down the lake, and you're going to learn to swim. I'm tired of fooling with you." So we went down there in that ice cold water, and the lake was just as clear as you could see, clear the bottom of any place, and wasn't dark. And so he kept me down there for the better part of the day, and finally got me underwater. And he said, "Well, one thing, Fitzgerald, we got you underwater. Now how are we going to get you back up?" I don't think I've ever learned to swim, but I admit for him. And he did a lot of people that way. He was a marvelous bird that way. But he was a hiker that wouldn't quit. And we'd always have horses. Now, Mr. Carter, the father, his dad, we'd get him a horse. He was old. I mean, he was, gosh sakes, he's, I don't know. To me, he was just awfully old. But he would never ride the horse. We'd always have a horse for him if he had to. All up there in those mountains and place, why, he'd get up and fix breakfast. He loved to cook out there. It was all outdoor cooking. He was an expert cook. And he'd get breakfast and there, and before the rest of us get the horses back up and ready to go, if we were moving that day, he'd take off ahead. He always had two sticks, pretty good ones. We kind of carved out a little bit. Anyway, he'd walk with his two sticks. And my fondest memory of him, he would, like we were at North Minor Meadows, we were at Steamboat Lake. And we were going to go over the Long Lake, which is up quite a steep ridge to get up the top. But anyway, Mr. Carter would walk as far as he could, and you'd find him. I can still see him right there talking about this. He had these two sticks over his shoulder, and he'd be sitting on a rock, and he had always carried a little pocket testimony. And it was John, and he'd be sitting there reading his little book of John.
You mean the New Testament?
Yeah. And so I didn't have much of a camera, but I took some pictures of him. And now here's the Indian. He did not want his picture taken. He didn't know. Nobody knew this. I snapped these pictures of him sitting on this rock and wherever. And I think I got three or four of them, but they were just little things. And when Mr. Carter finally passed away, and Harvey was principal of Central School, and so I went up there this one day and to the school. I said, "Harvey, do you have any picture of your father?" "Oh," he said, "good gosh, no." I said, "He would not allow his picture to be taken. We have no family pictures of him." I said, "Well, how about these four?" He said, "Where'd you get those?" I said, "Well, one morning when we left Steamboat Lake and went up to the ridge, I took a couple up there and a couple of someplace else where we were." And Harvey didn't want to think of it. They weren't great pictures, but because you know why they don't? They didn't want their picture taken. You know why that steals their soul?
Yeah.
There's a combination of Christian belief and Indian belief, see. And he didn't. Boy, he was adamant about that. But so anyway, other Indian experience with people that I knew, they used to come up the Umatilla River and come up that Thomas Road that comes up to Ruckel. Do you know where that is out here? Well, if you come up, you come through the reservation.
From Pendleton?
Yes. And then that Thomas Road climbs up and it comes up to Ruckel Ridge, and it's one of the very earliest roads into this area. And
where is that in relation to Cabbage Hill?
Well, if you go, are you familiar with the reservation at all?
No.
Well, you know where the gambling place is. You know where the railroad tracks run through there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you cross the railroad tracks and take a right, and you go right through the reservation. And then you go on up the Umatilla River, and there's what they used to call Bingham Hot Springs, but it's been sold several times. Some big dude ranch just bought it, I understood. There it has real nice hot water there and a beautiful lodge. But anyway, you just continue on that. Well, then the Umatilla kind of winds around and goes up toward Tollgate from there. Now, the road that comes from Elgin over to Weston, that would be to the north of the Umatilla River. The Ruckel Ridge, that's where the Umatilla starts, down that Thomas Road and in there. That's the be the North Fork, I guess. And then it goes down and then where it comes out of the area off to the right of the road that runs to Ukiah, the South Fork, meets down there in the bottom of that canyon. That's where the Thomas Road takes off. And then came in here. At one time, there was a railroad, and I'm not sure which company it was, but it wasn't any of the people that are here now, the later railroad. It was some railroad that was going to come in, as far as I understood it, it was going to come in kind of through the Pondosa country from that direction. And it went so far that it came down to the valley and it was going to cross. And you used to be able, if you were flying, you could still see where the right-of-way paralleled out over to the east a bit. The right-of-way, they never built. To be honest, just surveying it and kind of staking it out and roughed up the ground enough you could still see it in the wheat fields for a long time. And
is this the north end of the Grand Ronde Valley you're talking about?
Yes. I don't know where it came in, where the right-of-way came in, but it crossed over by from Cold in that general area and came across here and went down to, was going to go to Somerville. Then it would turn up Ruckel, where Ruckel Road is now, but coming down off that Ruckel Ridge. And they were going to tunnel through there. And that ridge, I've heard, I don't know, say that if they tunneled under the Ruckel Ridge and came out, it'd be right on the headwaters of the Umatilla River. And
sounds like a mighty tunnel.
Well, it's surprisingly just that far. And that's the big argument, that if that outfit had come from there and had a real railroad and put tunneled under there, then instead of being up over this, mm-hmm. it's all downhill through the Pendleton. Mm-hmm. And it was, but they, for whatever reason, they pulled out and didn't ever finish it. But
terribly expensive.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that it's terribly expensive compared to this thing when you think of the two places that we've got here that are nightmares to anybody, is this mountain here and Glad Canyon. So. Anyway, that's it. But I started to get off track there. But these Indians, it seemed like every time I'd be over there in that country around Ruckel, and I've never gone down that road down to go down to the reservation. But the Indians used to come up in here. They'd be huckleberry and everything. It seemed like every time I ever got up there, here they'd be about time they'd be coming home, and they'd have their. They all had pickup trucks, of course, in those days, or later days, but they would always have their TV poles stuck down on the back end of the bed, or however they had them tied on, they were longer than that. And then they had them up over the roof, the pickup sticking away out. And they'd have tassels hanging on them and the stuff that they didn't take off them when they knocked down their out, in other words, they would pack them. And they'd be headed back for the reservation. And I met quite a few of them, like Minthorn, Minthorn. They still live at Torn, you know where Torn Hollow is over on the Umatilla River?
No.
Well, if you take that other fork I'm talking about, that Umatilla River goes over, and I don't know where it peters out, someplace up there, Fort Tollgate up in those mountains, but it comes down through the valley in Thorn Hollow. Do you know where Adams, Oregon is on that highway from Pendleton to
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Well, if you turn right at Adams, you'll see a sign that says Thorn Hall down there.
Oh, yes.
And
now, were you having these encounters with the Indians who had been huckleberrying when you were a young man?
Mm-hmm.
In your 20s, 30s?
Well, most of my life became... I was married when I was 20. I was 20 and 21 in December. I was married in September. The war broke out in Europe on the day I got married. And most of this adventures that I had, such as they were, with the Indians was prior to that time.
I see. Okay. I just wanted to try to orient it in the century.
And but it seemed like our paths crossed an awful lot. And
how would the Indians dress at that time?
Well, it depended on what generation it was. The older Indians, like when Gilbert's family, when they came over to church here, the ladies dressed with the shawls and the lace-up, well, they're not, I don't remember the term, but it's not moccasins, it's a, they're beaded and they came up about so.
Or like boots.
Yeah, kind of. And they dressed, and had that's not the Indian way, but it's the way they dressed after they were, let's say, civilized.
Forcibly inducted into Western ways.
But the men always, the older, say, the Indians that were older to me when I saw them, they all looked alike because this hat always was a great big Stetson, pulled right straight down, and they're always big. And they had maybe some little bead work someplace on them. And then they always wore scarves. And sometimes it would be a beaded jacket, sometimes it would just be a coat, or, you know, just a regular store-bought, whatever. Probably bought it at Hamley's. But there, and they didn't, I don't recall seeing many of them in, not cowboy boots. They had, I don't really recall what they wasn't moccasins, but they had a, I really think maybe somebody over there in that Pendleton area made them for them special, because you could buy them at the store, at Hamley's. But anyway, they would, that's the way you see them, and there was kind of a, that was kind of a dividing line between the younger Indians and them, and then the older Indians, the really older ones. And you didn't see much of them because they rarely ever left the reservation.
Now, was that about the time that you said the Indians were looking bedraggled?
Oh, I think, this is another tale. I think I told you, my father passed away in 1935, and during that time, say from January 35 up until the war came, I had about, I don't know how many mentors. I mean, people just, I was a kid that needed a dad and didn't have one, and I had a lot of dads. Fortunately. Now, Harley Smith, who would be related to the Smith, Conley, Gray, Miller set up over Cole. Harley was I think he'd be some kind of a cousin to Maxine Conley or Maxine Stewart. He was also I don't know which is it. There's, when you say Smith, there's there aren't many of them. Well, anyway, my sister-in-law was a Smith, and they were cousins of some kind. So, I mean, you know, it gets all mixed up. Well, anyway, Harley had a place over here You know where the Blue Mountain Crossing thing is up here at Spring Creek, where you go in to see the old trail?
Yes.
Well, it's this side of that. Mm-hmm. You go through California Gulch, but you come up on this flat. And Harley was raised up there. In that, I have no idea what the cabin was. Oh, I guess maybe 20 by 30 log cabin. It had a little stoop on it later on that somebody put stuck out there, concrete or stones or something to sit on. But this was a long time ago, in the last century, not 1900, 1800. And Harley talked about when they, his term was when we put the Indians on the reservation. And I don't know what Indians they were, where they came from, but he said he sat on that stoop, a little kid, and he said, as a child, I was scared to death of those Indians. But they trailed them by there, and he said, in a single line, right over the old Oregon Trail. And he said, in later years, as I thought about, they didn't have anything. Very few of them were even mounted on horses.
Where had they come from?
Well, I don't know.
Gathered up from wherever they were. Yeah. would we probably say they were members of the Umatilla tribe?
Well, I doubt it. You see, this was a gathering place here. This,
yes.
If you know the history of this valley,
uh-huh.
This was a neutral ground. Mm-hmm. And they came in from a lot of places. Mm-hmm.
But they didn't stay very long.
No. No, they didn't. And
I thought they went back home to wherever they
had been. Well, yeah, it could have been, you know.
These would have been in that.
But you see, it's hard to say because of the intermingling of the Indians, intermarriage between tribes.
Yeah.
For instance, Kamiakan over at Tri-Cities, he was not a Yakima or any of the tribes right there. He came from north, off of a little up there by over that north freeway crosses, east and west freeway that crosses and goes. It goes up by George Washington.
Yeah,
right in there.
Spokane, Ellensburg.
Yeah, and he came from that tribe, and he was a politician. He was building his own private. He was working for himself, and that tribe up there was very poor, and didn't have much going for him. He marries this. I can't say that chief's name, the Yakima. Anyway, he married into that. Married the chief's daughter. Over time, he became the head of Kamiakan, became the head of the Yakima Nation, and he was hell on the. He had a real dislike and hatred for the white people, and he tried to promote a war between the combined nations, Cayuse and Walla Walla, and at one point in time, he came here with the idea of driving the white people clear out of the whole area.
This would have been the last part of the 18th century?
Well, I'd have to go get the book and look at that particular time frame up. No, it would have been earlier because, but anyway, this the way this story ends up, I won't put this on tape. The Mormon Church had armory, they made guns at Salt Lake. they tried to get the Indian tribe stirred up. And their meeting was right here in this valley. They tried to get the Indian tribe with the proposition they would supply the guns. Arm the Indians and then fight the whole, chase all the white people out.
How do you know that?
Well, you know Alvin Josephy. Mm-hmm. Okay, he writes about it. And so the Nez Perce sent a big group here, and they're all that stopped it. They were big enough that they said, we have no argument with the white people. At that point in time, they didn't. So that supposedly died right here in this valley, that uprising. The Bannocks were for it, and Shoshones, and quite a group of them that were kind of wanting to do this. But when the Nez Perce said no. Now out of that...
They were going to drive the white settlers out of the whole of Eastern Oregon?
Yeah, well, hell, the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
And they couldn't get the backing, but Kamiakin was the chief honcho. We just came by Battleground State Park the other day, drove by there, and down that draw that goes down from have you been over Battleground State Park?
No, I don't think so.
That's out of Pendleton on the way to John Day. Huh. And anyway, down in there in the bottom, but they had a lot of fighting among the Indians after that, and I can't remember the name of the Indian chief, but whichever group got in a fight down there for a Battleground State Park is his name. They killed the chief down in there. And that slowed something up. Then there was a guy named was up like Dayton and all up there, whatever tribe was up in there. And I can't say this name, it's like P-E-O, Mox. Pew Pew or Pew. Those two words together, Mox. And he was murdered by the people over there. Had a lot of Indian uprisings out of the ones that wanted to chase all of the white people out of here and there. But anyway,
of course, the white people who were here in violation of the treaty.
Well, yeah, but they weren't not here. They weren't.
Well, the treaty that I read about, 1855, I think it was, said that all of Western Oregon, on the other side of the Cascades, would be the white settlers, and all of the East would be for the Indians.
Yeah. Well, it just reminds me that there was plenty of trouble between the Indians, mm-hmm. and that always makes me kind of upset when I hear that the Indians thing about what we did to them. Okay, sure, but that's the history of mankind up to that point in time. The Indians were doing to each other. I mean, there wasn't anybody meaner on God's earth than the Mandan Indians up in Montana.
Yeah.
And I think when the white man gave them smallpox, I think that most of the Indians up there, they said, kill I don't know if there was ever even one survivor of the Mandan tribe, and the white men got rid of him. I don't think there are many unhappy Indians about that, because I don't think anybody wanted to meet him. So, you know, I mean, there's two sides to a coin.
And when you said you heard a lot of lies about the Battle of the Grand Ronde,
yeah.
Do you think you know what the truth is?
No, because I've read so many accounts of it. And now for your edification, big part of the battle took place right out here at this river, right here, this very spot.
How do you know that?
Well, because that's where it was fought.
What records are...
Well, okay,
is this for that?
There's a monument over here at the corner, Mount Glenn Corner. what they did on the Indian. Now this part, you know, is a fact. Now, how many people were killed, and how wild it was, and so on and so forth. It just depends on who's telling the story. Now, right over at that corner, that monument says this is where the battle was fought. Well, it, to that extent, I suppose maybe there's somebody fought right on that corner. I'm not sure of that. I don't think they knew where the Mount Glen Road was at that time. But anyway, that's it. Now, the story, as far as I think most people knew how the battle was fought, the Indians, where they were located, where they came in from, I don't know for sure. But the idea behind the battle, as far as the white people were concerned, was to split the Indians. And whether it was from up here this way or over here this way, the thing that they did is called the Place of the Cottonwoods, right through here at that time. And the Indians sent the women and children right down here to this area. And somehow or another, whoever, wherever they came from, and you can hear that they came from the over at Walla Walla, where the whites were strong, Fort Walla Walla and so on, they came in here. So if they came in this direction, they would have been going this way, and they